Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone. Welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we're going to talk about, junk in space.
Space junk.
Space junk. Or orbital debris, if you prefer, if you want to be all official about it. So let's talk, what is space junk? What is it? I'll take the pressure off of you,
okay.
Joe.
What is it?
Okay, space junk, it's debris in space. It's stuff that's defunct. It's no longer working. It is stuff that has accumulated in orbit around Earth that we can no longer control or use in any meaningful way that now is kind of an issue.
That's what I was going to say.
Oh, was
it? It can be any number of things. Lots of different things are. We've put a lot of junk in space.
Yeah, and just to be clear, we're pretty much going by the NASA approach to defining this. They call it orbital debris usually, and they define it as man-made objects. So this does not include things that would occur out there due to like asteroids or meteoroids. None of that. We're talking specifically about man-made objects, or really pieces of man-made objects that are in orbit around the Earth. And there's a lot of different types of it. I mean, you're talking about everything from defunct spacecraft that were left up there, spacecraft being anything like satellites.
Like whole spacecraft.
Well, yeah. In some cases, we're talking about like whole space. If you call a satellite a spacecraft, because it is capable of moving through space,
then yes.
You know, what's funny is the idea that after a spaceship, they stop using it. It doesn't just fall.
No, it stays in orbit for, depending on how high altitude it is, it may stay there for a couple of years or more than a century, but we'll get into that.
So,
yeah, it all depends on the altitude of the orbit. So, first of all, we're talking about things like defunct satellites, upper stages of launch vehicles, which in the early days of the space race, those launch vehicles would separate in orbit. It wouldn't,
these days they usually fall off into the ocean before they hit orbit.
Yeah, they usually are at an altitude where their orbit degrades so rapidly as to be practically non-existent. So yeah, they're designed so that they will fall back to Earth into an ocean, which is, that's pretty much where you're going to hit.
Statistically,
three
speaking.
Times out of four, because of how much ocean is covering the Earth, but also carriers for payloads. So just think of that as like a cargo truck, like the truck part that's kind of left up there. The debris created as a result of different collisions and explosions. Some of those collisions were on purpose. Some of them were accidental. I'll talk about the on-purpose ones in a minute. Solid rocket motor effluents. So solid rockets use solid rocket fuel, and sometimes they don't burn it all up, and sometimes bits of that solid rocket fuel will end up being exposed to space and become this space debris that's flying around. Debris that was intentionally released during spacecraft launch or vehicle release. So this might be something that when you're blowing the seal between one part of a spacecraft and its launch vehicle ends up being ejected out into space as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even tiny specks of paint are considered space debris. So paint can chip off due to collisions, whether something is getting hit by tiny little particles or even thermal stress. So if it's undergoing lots of different heating and cooling, sometimes paint chips off, and that paint can represent space debris.
I've also heard that there's stuff such as discarded astronaut gloves, spatulas, cameras, and crystals of human pee.
Pea crystals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Depending upon your belief in various conspiracy theories, there might be
some former
cosmonauts floating around up there too.
I'm sure there are just a few chainsaws.
Yeah, you know.
You know, I'll never forget when Leatherface went to space.
Well, no,
brought those chainsaw collection.
Don't say that. Someone will make that movie.
They made Jason in space, and they made the Leprechaun in space. I'm waiting for.
You don't remember that? Yeah, Canada had the rocket chainsaw program where they spent several decades just rocketing chainsaws into space.
Was it powered by maple syrup or?
Oh, powered by rockets.
Okay.
By chainsaw magic.
Chainsaw magic. All right. Joe's a little loopy, guys. So let's talk about some of the more interesting stories, I think, of the events that have led to large amounts of space debris being spread over the Earth.
Right, because we, I mean, a lot of this stuff is accidental, but we in the past have created space debris almost on purpose.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily because we wanted to, well, it definitely wasn't that we wanted to make things more difficult. We just wanted to try and
test. We just wanted to blow stuff up.
It's, yeah. I guess it's kind of like littering. It's easy.
Well, it wasn't easy. It was rocket science, actually. So in the 1960s and 70s, there was this little thing going on at full speed by then. It had been in development for years. It's called the Cold War. Do you guys remember that? Actually, I do remember that. You guys wouldn't. And so
I saw some James Bond movies and the third Rambo movie. I think I got it.
Okay, all right. So you got a good grounding. So yeah. The Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. That was what a lot of the space race was about, was who can dominate space first.
And well, it was really who can launch things powerful enough to get into space and therefore probably also at your nation.
Yeah. Well, especially the early days where the launching of satellites really meant, hey, look how far we can shoot this thing. We could probably hit you as well. Because if you look at those early satellites like Sputnik, the original Sputnik, the technical sophistication of that was that it could go beep. Frequently. That was it.
Well, but it could go beep frequently and loud enough for various people with ham radios to
pick
hear
up
it,
on it. Yeah.
And therefore, you know, it was proven.
Right. It was one of those things that scared people because it said, oh, look how far they can shoot. Well, the space debris kind of comes out of that same thought process. The idea was to develop missile systems that had anti-satellite capability so that you could shoot down your enemy satellites. Because that was another fear, was that if they can put something up there, they can spy on us. And if they're going to spy on us, then that's bad. We need a way of taking care of that and wiping out those spy satellites. And so there were tests both in the United States and the USSR where they would launch these anti-satellite missiles that would collide with satellites and then blow up and then cause a lot of space debris, both from the missile and from the satellite that was the target practice.
Hmm.
Yeah. That, by the way, not we didn't just leave that off in the 60s and 70s. By we, I'm talking about humans in general.
Not the three of us.
No, not the three. We have never, as to my knowledge, none of us, and I'm going to even include Noel. I'm going to be generous and include Noel, our producer, in this. None of us, to my knowledge, has ever shot an anti-satellite missile at a satellite and caused more space debris.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Moving on, before we put on more lists, in 1988, the U.S. changed its official policy to minimize the creation of new orbital debris, saying that
That was after we kind of realized that this was becoming an issue, that it wasn't just like, oh, it's harmless, space is really big, most of it'll fall down anyway, it's totes fine.
Yeah, this was when they realized that, no, we're starting to clutter up some very valuable regions of space. Not what I think most people would call the most valuable, we'll get into that, the most valuable space real estate around the Earth is relatively safe from space debris, which is a good thing. But and on June 3rd, 1996, there was an explosion. A Pegasus hydrazine auxiliary propulsion system exploded. And at that time, in 1996, it became the worst space debris incident in history. Because the altitude and orbit of that particular satellite, it presented a potential threat to both the Hubble Space Telescope and to space shuttle crews, which prompted NASA to really study the effects of space debris on potential operations with greater urgency. Specifically, they wanted to look at how could this affect, say, an astronaut that's on a spacewalk, and how do we mitigate this? How do we plan so that we minimize any threat that these astronauts would undergo in this kind of situation. And then before 2007, according to NASA, the principal source of debris was from explosions of old launch vehicle upper stages left in orbit with stored energy sources such as residual propellants and high pressure fluids. But on January 11th, 2007, China caught up with the US and the USSR by firing a missile at the Fengyong 1C weather satellite. So this was another test of an anti-satellite missile system. I remember when this happened. I remember hearing about it in the news. Well, from their perspective, it worked. The missile collided with the satellite and went boom. But it also means that it created what Encyclopedia Britannica calls the worst space debris event at that time. That has since been surpassed. You'll be happy to know, I'm sure. but it created more than 3,000 fragments. And the mass of the particles was spread out over the course of 2 years to create a cloud of debris that encircles the Earth. So you can actually look at some great images online that will show you the specific pathway. It's like imagine one line of orbit around the Earth, just cluttered with debris, and that's just from this one satellite. Now imagine that with lots of other degrees, so that you have all these other rings encircling the Earth at different points. In some cases, they crisscross with each other, and you can start to see the problem that if you want to put anything within these orbits, this range of altitude, you're going to encounter big clouds of space debris, or potentially you'll encounter them. Keeping in mind, even at that altitude, space is big. It's not like you're guaranteed to get hit, but you are certainly more prone to getting hit by space debris. And if you're hit by space debris, here's the really bad news. You create more space debris.
All right. Mm. And also, I mean, that space debris, even if it's a fleck of paint or a crystal of pee, that crystal is moving at thousands of kilometers an hour, which we're going to get into in a moment.
Yeah.
I think that there were a couple more notes on the timeline.
Sure, yeah, 2009. Yeah, we're not done with the happy stories yet. 2009, that's when an American and a Russian communication satellite collided. The Russian satellite was defunct. The American one at that time was not. It was afterward. That ended up being a massive collision that now, according to NASA, the results of that collision account for one third of all cataloged space debris. So not necessarily all space debris ever, but all the stuff that NASA has cataloged, one third of it comes from this collision.
Wow.
On January 22nd, 2013, a piece from that Fengyang 1C satellite that the Chinese shot with the missile, one piece of that collided with a Russian BLITS, Blitz satellite, which was this really cool kind of think of a sphere, a mirrored sphere in space, and it changed the orbit and spin period, actually broke it into at least two pieces. And the purpose of that satellite was to test a retroreflector design and act as a laser ranging device, and now it don't work no more. So that's just an overview of some of the events that have created this massive cloud of space debris. Which kind of, I guess, leads to the question of how massive are we talking about? And it's bad news. If you're looking at objects that are larger than 10 centimeters, NASA says there are about 21,000 pieces out there.
That sounds like a whole lot, but then again, the Earth's pretty big.
Yeah. Of course, if you were to look at objects between 1 to 10 centimeters, so 10 centimeters are larger, that's 21,000 pieces.
Mm-hmm.
If you look between 1 and 10 centimeters, you're talking more about 500,000 pieces flying around.
Yeah.
If you go down to less than 1 centimeter, then you're getting into huge numbers. And even the tiniest particles are a problem. Now, granted, a lot of the spacecraft, in fact, the spacecraft that is being designed today has shielding as part of the spacecraft for just for these kind of these possible collisions.
Impacts, right.
Yeah. So most of them have shielding that will protect them from collisions of things up to about 3 or 4 centimeters in size. But that's where we get into some of the problems with, you know, even if it's small, it's still a huge issue, right? I mean, first of all, I want to say that I think it's amazing that NASA can apparently identify and track objects as small as 3 millimeters from ground radar stations.
Yeah,
in space. I had no idea until I started researching this. I mean, that's an incredible level of precision.
Yeah, no, considering that I can't find my keys in my own room, I'm going to go ahead and say that
I can't find my glasses when I'm wearing them.
Huh.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier about how even a little paint chip could cause a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of hard to imagine because these things are built really strong. And if you just stand next to them throwing a paint chip at them, or even I'd say like a baseball or something, it doesn't seem like you can do very much damage.
Yeah.
Well,
I can see that.
Here's where some Newtonian physics comes in.
Right. let's talk about momentum for a second.
Well, actually, I think what we want to talk about, it's similar, is kinetic energy.
Sure.
Kinetic energy is the force you get when it's the ability of something moving to do work.
Yeah.
So the kinetic energy of an object, say, flying through space is 1/2 mass times velocity squared.
All right. Now, velocity is speed plus a direction.
Yeah. Okay. So Okay, well, the paint chip, what's the mass there? It's got to be really small.
Yeah, but
you know,
when you look at the speed, so the speeds we're talking about, debris traveling at around 7 or 8 kilometers every second.
And furthermore, when, if you know, for example, they're traveling in opposite directions, like that 2009 American and Russian communication satellite collision happened at some 42,000 kilometers per hour.
Yeah, so yeah. At that speed, when you get a lot of speed, it doesn't, you know, the mass of the object is, obviously it's important because it's going to be a factor in that equation, but even a small particle has the potential to do huge amounts of catastrophic damage.
Right.
So, when you're talking at those speeds, there's no such thing as, oh, well, that's tiny.
If you extrapolate, if you go beyond Newtonian physics and get close to relativistic speeds, where you're talking about a paint chip going near the speed of light, that paint chip turns into a nuclear bomb.
Sure. Yeah, and while that paint chip might not do any damage against, say, a spacecraft, because a spacecraft has some shielding on it that will protect it against those small particle collisions, if it's an incredibly unlucky astronaut on a spacewalk, it has the potential of doing at least some damage to the spacesuit, which could be catastrophic for the astronaut inside. So, it's moving around these incredible speeds, and when you've got that level of momentum in the equation, you have to be cognizant of it. As for where all this stuff is, most of it is in an altitude that's within 2,000 kilometers of the Earth's surface, which sounds, you know, pretty big. In fact, a lot of it is between 750 and 800 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. And debris below 600 kilometers altitude will end up falling to the Earth within a few years. You remember when I said it might take more than a century?
Mm-hmm.
Well, above 1,000 kilometers, that's where you're running into it, where it's going to take at least a century, possibly more, for the orbit to decay enough for that object to start to fall to the Earth. Keeping in mind that an orbit is essentially just a sustained fall anyway. You're falling at a speed.
You're falling in a turning motion.
Yeah. You're falling toward the Earth at the same, you know, at a rate that's comparable to the rotation of the Earth. So, and you're falling at an angle where it's like you're just in constant free fall.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a real problem for any spacecraft that needs to be in that range. Not all spacecraft do need to be in that range. Things that are in geostationary orbit are much higher up.
Yeah, that's something like 35,700
kilometers.
Kilometers, yeah.
And in that range, there's really not that much space debris. And most operators who have some sort of spacecraft up in that range, you know, we're talking about like telecommunication satellites, that sort of stuff that needs to be in geostationary orbit. That's where we've got this satellite that's above a kind of a fixed point along the equator of the Earth. It's very valuable real estate. They consider it a natural resource that's very important. So operators who are working on spacecraft that is about to go to the end of its life, you know, at the end of its life, instead of just leaving it there, they will usually boost it out of that orbit, you know, which takes a lot of energy, but it does mean that you free up that space for something else to take up, because there's only a limited number of spaces in that orbit that you can use. So this way you end up conserving that by allowing someone else to take the space that satellite used to be in. But which is why that's one good thing. Like if we were to talk about a massive problem with space debris, we probably wouldn't see a huge impact on things like weather satellites and communication satellites, because they tend to be at altitudes higher than where a lot of the space debris is. So that's some good news, but there are a lot of other satellites that would be affected, not to mention any kind of operations for things like the Hubble Space Telescope, other space telescopes.
Also, just getting things into space would eventually start becoming a problem.
Sure, getting past this kind of, you know, field of junk.
I think of that not entirely scientifically accurate scene in WALL-E where they're trying to escape the Earth. And
right.
They have to, like, bust through a cloud of
satellites. I think it's fair to say that's not entirely scientifically accurate. But yes,
But it is true that real estate up there is limited.
Yeah.
I mean, and you could run out of space.
Right, in space.
And long before you ran out of space, you'd probably run out of space that it was safe to use simultaneously.
Or even just like you were saying, Lauren, or just flying to get to, like, even if you're going beyond that point, you still have to get through that section. And, you know, as I said, these, the amount of space debris increases over time, even if you don't shoot anything else up there, because anything that's up there now, eventually it's going to collide with something else. It's really just a matter of time. Assuming that you don't have it come back down to Earth, eventually it's going to collide with something, which means that it creates more space debris. So even if we halted all space operations right now and never sent anything else up, we would see space debris increase over time, at least until
for the first, you know, few dozen years.
Yeah,
at least.
A century or so. Mm-hmm. You know, once you get through a century, then you'd probably end up having significantly
more
less
of it dropping
up there.
Out.
Now, the reason why I thought it'd be interesting to talk about this right now is because a few weeks back, a movie called Gravity came out. And I went and saw this movie. Have either of you seen it?
Nope.
No, I really wanted to. But,
it's a fantastic film. I've got problems with it. there are some problems with its physics, but it's a fun, highly stressful film. So if you don't deal with stress very well, then I don't necessarily say that you should go out and see it.
I certainly wanted to see it because I yearn for films that get the... I say this like I've been to space. I haven't been to space, but I was going to say to get the terror of space right, at least as I would imagine it. I mean, just knowing what you know about how empty and huge and awe-inspiring and inspiring and horrifying at the same time space is, so many movies make it so mundane. Space is a soundstage, you know?
Yeah, space is just... the bit you go through to get from point A to point B.
Yeah.
And not really anything to consider beyond that. But if you were to think of it in the terms of you are in a self-contained environment within this space suit that you cannot get out of, because if you did, you would die. Because space, as we have said many times, is trying to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And you were to become separated from your spacecraft with no actual means of propelling yourself back toward it, that I can't, you know, you would just imagine you would have a rapidly escalating panic attack leading possibly to despair if you didn't pass out from the stress of it all. And that's kind of what they are depicting in the film Gravity. And in Gravity, you've got a ludicrously underprepared astronaut who is working on the Hubble Space Telescope when there is a catastrophic impact with space debris caused by Russians firing a missile at a satellite. So this is not an unprecedented event, as we've talked about in this very podcast. The space debris becomes a hazard and ends up separating this astronaut from her spacecraft. And the rest of the film is pretty much her attempts at surviving in the least survivable environment we can think of, short of being suddenly finding yourself like either in a molten core of the Earth or underneath the, you know, in the Marianas Trench or something, but it's pretty inhospitable.
Pretty bad, yeah.
So, it's, you know, I thought it was interesting to bring up because a lot of the stuff they bring up really does play into this, that terror you're talking about. Even if everything's going right, I would imagine that a lot of astronauts feel a small sense of, I'm a little scared. You know,
well, it's so easy to forget that we live on a ball of iron hurtling around a fire so big that you cannot imagine it.
Yeah, I often forget that, you know, while I'm watching my TV. So let's talk about some of the approaches to fixing this problem. So first of all, we've talked a little bit about improving
You mean the script problems and
Gravity?
No,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I mean the space junk problem
itself. Space junk problem. Okay.
Script problems and Gravity are beyond our help because the movie has already come out. Although I did enjoy Gravity, but I have some nits to pick, but that's a different podcast. So talking about space junk and how to solve that, one is to try and minimize producing more space junk by better designing our space vehicles. So creating that kind of shielding, being able to decommission the spacecraft at the end of their useful lives by bringing them back to the Earth safely, that kind of thing. But even if we did all that and everything was working great, the stuff that's already up there is already causing damage and is just going to continue to do so and continue to cause headaches for anyone who's trying to plan out a space exploration mission. So some of the solutions involve some pretty interesting approaches, mostly grabbing stuff and then hauling it down or pushing it down to the Earth. And there are a couple of different approaches. I saw one that involved harpoons, where we would send up a harp, essentially, it is, a little spacecraft, a satellite, essentially, that would have power and would be able to harpoon space debris.
A little
and
then, Ahab.
Yeah. Yeah, the Ahab one. And that would aim at the ocean and maybe even hit a white whale on the way down. But the idea would be that it would pierce whatever the debris is and then tow it back down into the Earth's atmosphere and where it would be destroyed, essentially, from the massive pressure and heat. Then there's the Clean Space One.
That was the Swiss one, right?
Yeah.
With the claw game?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you've ever seen the claw game, you know, or Toy Story, you know what I'm talking about. The claw game that you would see in fairgrounds or arcades.
Yeah, claw reaches out. You use it to pick up a toy.
That rigged,
hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Rigged cheater machine. Someone has designed to steal quarters from children until they cry.
Someone has never won a toy from the claw game. Yes. So anyway, if you imagine one of those claws mounted on kind of a cube that has a thruster on the back of it, that's more or less what the Clean One looks like, and the Clean Space One, rather. And the idea is to launch this in 2018, and the test is to try and retrieve a CubeSat, a little cube satellite that the Swiss launched in either 2009 or 2010, because there's actually two potential targets.
Those are those little 10 centimeter per side. What's that, like three and a half,
3.4 mm-hmm. inches to a side. Yeah, really small satellites. So this thing's not big, and the things it's collecting are not big, but as we've already established, it doesn't matter if it's big in space. If it's moving fast enough, it has the potential to cause damage. So the Clean Space One has this claw that would come out of the front of it and grasp this tiny little satellite, and then it would direct itself back toward Earth for destruction. So it's a one-way trip for this for Clean Space One, and that's also interesting. I'm curious to see if that works out. But my favorite uses something that we talked about on the podcast before, in a way, although this is, I argue the naming of this, but it kind of involves tractor beams.
I think that people just like saying the word tractor beam. So
yeah.
I think that's why they're
there's
calling
a beam
it that.
Involved.
Yes. And, an electrostatic beam, an electron beam.
An electron beam. Exactly. So, you know, when things accumulate excess electrons, they build up an electrostatic charge. This is the sort of stuff that happens when you rub your feet against the carpet and you build up that electrostatic charge. And
I think that's a really negative attitude, Jonathan.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Oh, let's not go down this road, Joe. You will not like where it leads. Anyway,
but charges can be positive or negative.
They can be.
And
so with this negative charge, like if you're talking about the kind of charge you build up when you shuffle your feet against the carpet and you zap somebody, that's not a significant charge. But the idea here is that we would have a satellite that would be able to project an electron beam at space debris until it developed enough of an electrostatic charge so that if you were to send a positively charged probe flying by it, the opposite charges would attract one another.
Mm-hmm.
Positive attracts negative and vice versa. So
you see my pun was relevant.
Huh.
I never said it wasn't relevant. I said you didn't want to see where that road led. So Lauren can back me up on this. So the positively charged probe flies by the negatively charged debris, and those opposite charges attract one another. The probe is powered, so it could pull
and
the defunct debris.
Yeah. And I think the idea on this one is to actually tow them into higher orbits and then fling them away from Earth rather than pulling them down.
Right, yeah. This would be the idea would be to try and move these out of the danger zone of Earth orbits entirely. you having a little Archer moment? Anyway, the problem here is that it would be a very slow process. It would take months of time to move a single piece of space debris. And you couldn't turn the electron beam off, because if you did, the space debris would start to accumulate other ions, positively charged ions.
It would very quickly become neutral. Right?
Yeah. Eventually the charge would just become neutral. Exactly. So your positively charged probe would just be flying off without it, because there would be nothing to attract the two anymore. Relationships just die.
Yeah. You know? The device, by the way, is being called the Glider, which is written a lot like GLaDOS, which I kind of appreciate, which stands for the Geosynchronous Large Debris Reorbiter.
Yeah. So, and that's another thing, is that this particular approach would be designed for specific types of space debris. It wouldn't work on everything. So this, you know, we're probably going to need a multi-tiered approach to addressing space debris in a way that that actually reduces space debris faster than the generation of space debris just from these collisions that are happening. So it's a big challenge. It's a huge challenge. And NASA, like I said, is mostly focused on minimizing the generation of space debris and then looking at what options are realistic and which ones are likely to have the best return so that we can reduce this issue effectively. So. Yeah.
And it's going to be really important, I think, for the future. I was reading a couple articles that we're looking forward to when we have, research or other settlements on the moon or on Mars where they do not have, the kind of atmospheres that will burn up debris as it falls. And they might not, well, I mean, in the case of the moon anyway, they don't have stable geosynchronous orbits that you can use, to keep satellites that we're going to need up there for technology to work.
For communication, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, for multiple reasons, but yeah. And so, how would you know what the moon weather is otherwise if you don't have a climate satellite up there?
And so dealing with all of that is going to be very important when we start moving out into those territories.
I have a question that you might not know the answer to, but
ask me the question.
I wonder if it's reasonable to think that space debris could become a problem beyond Earth orbit, like at other high and beyond, say, moon orbit, but at other... just static points in the solar system, say like the Lagrange points.
Like if we're going to start forming bands of artificial asteroids in places around the solar system, for example, that would, or artificial comets, for lack of a better word, that are just going to be zipping around.
It's certainly possible. I mean, especially when you're talking about extending space travel to places like Mars, I could, hopefully we will learn our lesson and make sure that whatever approach we use with Mars will minimize the chance for space debris. There are certain realities we have to face. For one, accidents happen. So sometimes we're going to see a malfunction that's going to cause space debris, or there could be a collision that we did not anticipate that could cause it. So I expect that it will always be an issue. The question is, how do we deal with it? And can we do it in such a way where we are reducing the impact as much as possible? No pun intended with impact. But that's the key, because I don't think there's any way to eliminate it. It's just, how can you mitigate it as much as possible so that space travel is a possibility, that space exploration is still a viable pursuit and not something where, sure, we could launch this multi-billion dollar telescope into low Earth orbit. And yeah, sure, we'd be able to see further than we've ever seen before, but there's a chance that it could get destroyed within its first 6 months of operation due to space debris, so no one's going to fund it. I mean, that would be a tragedy.
Oh, so. Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, and it's not that, I mean, sophisticated enough equipment has the capacity to maneuver around, like I know that they can maneuver the ISS if they see something coming.
Exactly. They say that about once a year they have to maneuver the ISS. They'll track space debris. The ISS is not in an orbit that is particularly endangered by space debris, but they say that if they track an object that looks like it's going to come within a few kilometers of the ISS, they'll then project the
chance of it hitting.
Right.
I think that if it's specifically, like, there's a greater than 1 in 10,000 chance of it impacting,
exactly,
then they go ahead and move the space station.
If they say the chances of impact are greater than 1 in 10,000, let's go ahead and use the propulsion system on the ISS to maneuver it to a safe distance. And they say it happens not frequently, but about once a year if you average it out. So it's not like, it's that time of year again.
Yep.
That space debris is coming back around.
April 4th.
Yeah.
Yep. No.
So, that's kind of, the rundown on space junk and how it is a real problem. It's not just, I've heard about that. That's annoying. If you ever look at NASA's, illustrations of space junk and you look, it just looks like there's a cloud of debris just completely enveloping the Earth. It's kind of terrifying when you look at it like that.
Though about half of that stuff is just cartridges of the E.T. game for the Atari 2600.
Yes, exactly. They launched it into low Earth orbit as opposed to burying it in a desert.
Well, you're going to run out of desert eventually. You've got to put those cartridges somewhere.
I don't know that they made that many of them, but we're going to go ahead and humor you. So let's wrap this up. All right, so that's kind of our discussion about space junk, how it is something to be concerned about in the long term for human exploration. I have every confidence that there are very smart people looking at ways to solve this. And I'm optimistic that we're going to find some ways to do this that will make sense from a scientific and financial perspective. I don't think we're ever going to completely eliminate space debris, but I have a feeling that given enough time, we're going to get a handle on it. It's just a question of how long is that time going to be. I think we should prioritize it personally because I like space. So guys, that wraps up our discussion. You should definitely go to fwthinking.com. That's our home website where you're going to find our videos, our podcasts, our blog posts, lots of other cool links that I know you guys are going to love. So make sure you visit that site. And remember, you can check us out on our social media platforms. Well, not ours. We're there. We don't own them. But Facebook and Twitter, it's FW Thinking for both of those. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.